fasten your seatbelt, turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
Johnny, get your gun, get your gun, get your gun. Take it on the run, on the run, on the run. Hear them calling you and me, everyone for liberty. Over there, over there. Send the word over there. That the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming, and we won't.
This anthem, written by George Cohen and recorded in 1917 by Nora Bays, marked the enthusiasm and innocence of a young world power that had been thrust suddenly into a conflict overseas. A great war to end all wars, led by a progressive politician, Woodrow Wilson, with a lasting impact not just over there, but over here as well. I'm Glenn Moberg. Today on Route 51, we're traveling back in time to those days of almost 100 years ago to see the lasting effects of World War I on our civil liberties, on the way we view war today, and on life in north central Wisconsin, where a large German immigrant population would find themselves targeted by a national, overtly racist propaganda campaign. We'll see how the Espionage Act and Sedition Act criminalized speech and how the debate continues today. We'll look at the great migration of African Americans from the South and the race riots that occurred during the war years in the North. And we'll look at how labor union activists were attacked during America's first Red Scare. Our guests today on Route 51 are Brett Barker, Associate Professor of History at UW-Marathon County, and joining us by phone, Mike Jacobs, Associate Professor of History at UW-Baraboo Sauk County. Our guests will lead a forum on World War I and civil liberties the evening of Wednesday, April 8th, at the Center for Civic Engagement on the UW-Marathon County campus in Wausau. It's the second in a series on the Great War, which is sponsored by the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. Now, as always, we welcome your phone calls. If you'd like to join the conversation, our lines are open at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it live on the air. Mike Jacobs, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Brett Barker, thanks for joining us. Tell us about the events April 8th here on the UW-Marathon County campus. Mike, let's start with you. What's bringing you up here from Baraboo?
Well, actually an invitation from my colleague. But Wisconsin Institute of Public Policy and Service, as you know, does great outreach regarding civic engagement. And I've been involved with them for a long time, so my good friends are kind enough to invite me whenever they have things that are relative to my expertise.
And you are an expert in some of the things that we're going to be talking about today. Mike?
Yes, I like to fashion myself as such. I'll let your listeners be the judge of that by the end of the day.
Well, tell us about this event on April 8th here on the UW-Marathon County campus and some of the things you'll be talking about. I know I touched on them in the introduction.
Brett, I'll defer to you on this, please.
Yeah, I think we're going to have a conversation between the two of us. It's going to cover some of the same material we're going to cover today, but talk about the what it was like on the home front and also some of the excesses that occurred and some of the ways in which civil liberties were attacked. And I think particularly given the background of central Wisconsin, I think also the anti-German campaign also will be a major thing we'll talk about that evening.
Why is this war, which started in Europe 100 years ago, in fact, it started 2 years before we got involved in it, why is it still significant today? Mike Jacobs?
Yeah. Sure. Well, I think it's significant because it really changed the character of the United States in so many ways. As you'd mentioned, the Great Migration really makes the African-American experience in the United States something that's national rather than peculiar to the South. And one thing that doesn't have to do directly with the curtailment of civil liberties is that I think that the war was an impetus to make women's suffrage a national phenomenon. I think that comes about because of this. And I think we'll also be able to draw some connections why prohibition, which, you know, is a topic today of concern because people have questions about the drug war and legalization of narcotics. You know, this comes to being because of World War I.
And is that because drinking was central to the German-American culture in many ways, and this was a way of singling out the Germans? I've heard that before, and I'm wondering if you think that argument holds water, Mike.
Well, Well, it does, but there's two parts of it, and let's address, you know, the first part, which is there's no question that grain is necessary for the war effort. And, you know, not only does the United States need to feed its troops, but much of Europe is war-torn and ravaged and unable to feed its own soldiers. So competition that once existed for American agribusiness has disappeared, and there is this need to satisfy that. You know, the United States wasn't the only one to institute prohibition at this time. Canada did as well. The British did, and believe it or not, so did the Germans. So that's the first part. But the second part is, yes, there is this anti-German campaign. I think what's really more important to me than the anti-German campaign regarding alcohol is that Germans in America had been the thrust of resistance for prohibition. And with outlawing essentially everything that is German during the war, they were in a position that they could no longer lobby against that without facing other kind of reprisals.
Now, Brett Barker, yeah. Why should anyone living in north central Wisconsin care about what happened 100 years ago?
Well, it's always a question historians face. I think that a lot of the issues that we still deal with questions about civil liberties, about the idea of expression during wartime, or even sort of a somewhat wartime, a sort of a post-9/11 world, really began to be discussed in a modern way in this era. And I think we can see a lot of the roots of the debates that still go on began back then.
And some of those Supreme Court cases that came down are still being referenced today when we talk about the limits of civil liberties and free speech, especially in a war environment.
Absolutely. And I think particularly two of them coming out of the war, and particularly Oliver Wendell Holmes' dissent in Abrams, but also his he concurred in the first case, which is called Schenck versus the United States. But there he said that when speech created a clear and present danger, and I think that's a not just because of the Clancy novel, but more generally, that's still a term that is thrown around, that when speech created a clear and present danger, that it could be limited. And that still, in some ways, is one of the benchmarks about free speech in a democratic society.
Is this where he came up with the phrase, free speech is limited, you can't shout fire in a crowded theater?
Yes, and I think it's an important point that's always embedded in that, but it's important to say, is in the decision, he actually said falsely crying fire in a crowded theater, because he wanted to draw the distinction, of course, if someone actually yelled fire and a theater was on fire and someone was hurt, you wouldn't be liable to that. But by creating a dangerous situation falsely, you could be prosecuted for your speech.
Well, we're going to get into this in more detail a little bit later in the program. I'm interested in how, just to kind of set the plate here, how all of this happened. I've read a little bit about World War I. And I still don't understand why it was fought, why it happened, and how the assassination of this seemingly minor figure, this Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria in the Balkans in Sarajevo, how could that lead to a conflict that involves so many countries, even involving America, and lead to millions of people dying? And for what?
I'm gonna let Brett answer that question, but I'm gonna add something to that question. I think us in America, the real question is, how did that European conflict come to involve us 3 years later? I think that's the really thing that's puzzling for American students that I find when I teach the class about this.
Right, and I think that's a question that I think reasonable people still ask. The background at the time was there were a series of alliances and treaties that set up a situation where when minor powers might go to war, it created a domino effect where people began to join on both sides, and you get these two sides that are suddenly engaged in a massive land war in Europe that to some extent even surprised the diplomats and the rulers of Europe at the time.
And I have read that in Austria, when this Archduke was assassinated, nobody seemed to care, at least not the general population. The reaction was certainly muted.
Right. And it certainly it really is much more about sort of Serbian nationalism and this small little Balkan power that wishes to be outside the realm of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And so it begins with a very small conflict in the Balkans and quickly spreads as different European nations have agreed to ally with one another if they go to war.
And we're still fighting over that stretch of territory of Serbia, the Balkans, Croatia, we've got the Crimean Peninsula, we've got Ukraine, yeah. And what do we have? We've got all of these alliances, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, where all of these groups are aligned on both sides. Could something like this conceivably happen again?
Well, that's interesting. I don't know if it would happen quite the same way again, but you do have this area of intense sort of a great deal of ethnic diversity, a great deal of nationalisms, which were some ways suppressed by the Austro-Hungarian Empire, later by Yugoslavia, and there is still a continuing sort of legacy of that place. The Balkans still raises a certain, as you mentioned, it still creates a certain danger today.
So this is how all of this happened. I'm just going to go through the dominoes here. Mm-hmm. Austria started cracking down on the Serbs, so in Serbia. So there were all these racial overtones with that. Austria ends up declaring war on Serbia. Russia declares war on Austria in response. Germany declares war on Russia. Then France is warned not to get involved, so they pull their troops back, but they start mobilizing, and that's not enough. So then Germany declares war on France. They invade Luxembourg, and then they declare war on Belgium when Belgium wouldn't let the German troops come through. And then the British decide to help France, and somehow we get involved a couple of years later.
Right. So that original, that's the domino effect I talked about with these sort of secret treaties and alliances, something that at the end of the war, Wilson and the 14 points, President Woodrow Wilson will say in the 14 points that there needs to be a more open diplomacy so that things like this don't happen and this sort of domino effect doesn't occur in the future. But as Mike said, the more, perhaps a more directly relevant question to us is then, the war begins in 1914, but then how is it that in April 1917, the United States decides to enter that war nearly 3 years in?
Well, it took 2 years to get Americans involved, 2 or 3 years, and we had an historic reluctance to get involved in foreign entanglements, going back to George Washington. Mike Jacobs, even the attack on the Lusitania in 1915 couldn't get us into the war right away.
No, it couldn't, and there's a lot of historians who make this argument. The first history of American diplomacy regarding World War One came out, and it's called, I don't want to get too technical, it's called the Submarine School. And these are people that argue that it was submarine warfare that got the United States ultimately involved in World War One. But as you're pointing out, the declaration of war was so far removed from the Lusitania that it makes it somewhat difficult to make that direct connection that would have happened. You know, I wanted to add something else about the, if I may, about the timeline that you mentioned. It's really a complicated question, and there's some nuances here if I can add. Because of the rise of the Second Industrial Revolution and how far Russia was behind, one thing that Russia did before they declared war was they actually started to mobilize. Now, the way the old diplomatic system worked is you declared war, and it took about 6 months to get mobilized. But the German plan, if they were ever faced in this kind of conflict, was to knock out the Russians after they could defeat the French. But once the Russians started to mobilize, the Germans felt they were in a position that they had to act quickly. So there's a lot of kind of things that had happened that had not been anticipated because of the change of technology.
Woodrow Wilson was elected in 1916 under the slogan, "He kept us out of war." What made Wilson change his mind, and how did he convince Americans to go along?
Well, you know, one thing is I could jump in. I guess I'm a little more of the submarine school than maybe Mike is. The Germans do resume unrestricted submarine warfare in early 1917. They decide that the calculated risk of bringing the United States into the war is outweighed by the damage they can do to U.S. goods moving across the oceans. And so they and other ships. So they begin to submarines again begin to torpedo ships. And that is maybe the proximate immediate cause. But as Mike suggests, by 1917, you really have a different environment. And in some ways, there's been increasing pressure for the United States to enter the war. There's also a school of thought that says that the United States, as they saw just how large and fundamentally significant this war had become, that Wilson and other people felt the United States had to have a place at the table when the war was over. And so being in the war would give us a role in the post-war world.
What about the role of Great Britain in this? We were once British colonies. What role did they have in spreading stories of German atrocities in America to get us involved? They were talking about something called the Rape of Belgium, if I recall.
Yes, that's absolutely true. The British employed an absolutely sophisticated and far-reaching propaganda machine aimed at influencing important people throughout the United States. They had people in place to give comments about the war, even on at newspapers that are on a regional level. They influenced college presidents. It was really a sophisticated scheme that they didn't really tell us about until after the war.
Were Americans taking sides with the older British descendants on one side and the newer German immigrants on the other?
Well, that's certainly one of the arguments that I think is a fairly strong one regarding American entry, and that is that people had some sort of affinity to their own cultural heritage. And if you look at the leadership that was employed in the Wilson administration, they were all pro-war and they were all pro-British. The one exception was the Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, who ultimately declared this vocally and resigned because of it.
You know, when we entered the war, there was a naive innocence, it seemed, to our involvement that was soon replaced by some very brutal realities. Trench warfare, machine guns, tanks, airplanes, poison gas, things that had never been used before on this scale in a war. Did that experience of all of these young men going over there, that's the song, Over There, you know, with this naivety and the sense of innocence and then coming back after they had seen all of these things, that had to change our character as Americans.
One thing I would say about that is, too, there is some truth to that, although compared to the European powers, the United States suffered relatively small casualties. We get in fairly late in the war. We do suffer casualties, but literally a generation of young Germans, French, and British were wiped out by the war. And so in some ways, the United States and EAEF, the soldiers that went over, experienced these things, but not to the same extent or duration that Europe did. So in some ways, I think you can argue we came out of the war a bit more naive, perhaps, than the Europeans were.
In fact, I'd like to build on what Brett just said. With the exception of the American Expeditionary Force that left almost, you know, immediately after the declaration of war, most American soldiers were in the field for only a matter of months. Most of them less than 6 months for the time it took them to get mustered, mobilized, sent over, and then deployed.
You know, I recall as a child growing up in Illinois, we had a senator, a Republican senator, Everett McKinley Dirksen, who had this mellifluous, low, ringing voice. He didn't come by that naturally. He got that voice by inhaling mustard gas when he was in the trenches. So, that's an aside. But to work on this concept of innocence, the anthem for that war Over There was written by George Cohen. And I'm going to play part of a recording by Arthur Fields. This was recorded in 1917, so it's going to sound a little scratchy. But I want you to listen closely to the lyrics because you're going to hear some pretty ugly racist overtones. This is Over There, recorded in 1917 by Arthur Fields.
Johnny, get your gun, get your gun, get your gun. Johnny, show the hug, you're a son of a gun. Hoist the flag and let her fly. Yankee doodle, do or die. Pack your little kit, show your grip, do your bit. Yankees to the ranks, from the towns and the tanks. Make your mother proud of you, and the old red, white, and blue. Over there, over there.
George Cohen's lyrics are, Johnny, show the Hun, you're the son of a gun. In this version, it's Johnny, kill the Hun, you're the son of a gun. Yankee Doodle, do or die, make your lover proud of you, and the old red, white, and blue. Cohen was later given the Congressional Gold Medal by President Franklin Roosevelt for this song. But Mike Jacobs, this business of portraying Germans as Huns and beasts, that was very real during those years.
Absolutely. In fact, it actually predates the war. When you look at Life magazine, after war started in Europe and 2 years before it comes to America, there's some really strong anti-German propaganda. There's some other things as well. When you mentioned racism, I thought, there's another pretty well-known song. It's called When Tony Goes Over the Top, Look Out for That Fighting Wop. And, you know, that's meant to be a very pro-American song, but absolutely the racism is pretty clear there as well.
I have never heard that, and I'm going to look it up now. Was there an overall effort during that time to discredit German culture, the food, the music, the artwork?
Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's, you know, we know Victory Gardens, and we know sauerkraut, you know, patriotic cabbage and other such things that we've changed names to. You know, one interesting fact is that the number of German language newspapers in the United States was reduced by about 60% in a five-year span during, you know, just before the war to the end of the decade.
You know, if you go to graveyards in central Wisconsin and you look at the tombstones from the early 1900s, you will see many of them written completely in German. Many of our German ancestors in this part of the state did not speak English. In fact, they didn't speak it for many years. They didn't even try to learn.
Correct, and there are areas in Marathon County, obviously, it has quite a German ancestry where German remained a vibrant language that was the language of commerce and of church and of the newspaper for quite a while after German immigrants arrived. And World War I is one of those periods where there is a real reaction against that across the nation. I mean, Iowa passed a law that said that all communications, oral communications, communications in school, and communications by telephone had to be in English during the war.
Well, yeah, and if I can give some regional examples, yeah. In Wausau, the National German-American Bank changed its name in January of 1918 to the American National Bank. But, you know, even when they had the previous name, they had been selling war bonds. They had been vibrantly supporting the American effort. But they felt there that sense about how Brett mentioned commerce was changing. So the Germania Insurance Company had a very public removing of the Germania statue in St. Paul, Minnesota, bringing it down to cheers of people. The Germania Insurance Company in Milwaukee was an even better story, which is the statue on top of the building disappeared overnight. No one knows to this day whatever happened to it.
But you're indicating, Mike, that some Germans did indeed support the American war effort. I mean, if you had the German National Bank selling war bonds.
Well, there's almost no exceptions the other way around. It was, I'm sure, it was over 99% of German-Americans, their loyalty was with the United States. Now, they may have favored the fatherland, if you will, before the United States entered. In fact, there were rallies that contained thousands of people that raised money for German and Austrian soldiers before the United States entered.
And, Brett, you had an example of a guy in Stevens Point who changed his name?
That's right. I think Mike actually pointed this out to me first, but from the city directory where you can see before U.S. entry into the World War One, he's listed as Wilhelm Schmidt, and it says he's a laborer on Water Street. After the war, he's William Smith, same address, same occupation. And that's clearly a decision on his point, on his part, to Americanize because of this incredible anti-German rhetoric that's going on during the war.
And Brett Barker, we even had a church in north central Wisconsin that was still doing church services in German.
Well, I believe into the early 1970s. So there's a long tradition, and many of our listeners probably know that the Pomeranians, we're speaking Plattdeutsch, and that's a proud part of the heritage. And what's interesting is during World War One, there is a real pressure to push that heritage down. The 1920 census, by the way, showed that 25% fewer Americans claim to have German ancestry than in 1910. And that's largely a decision to hide that German ancestry in the wake of all this.
And there's a group in Wausau that is trying to bring back Plattdeutsch, or Low German, as it's colloquially called. Mm-hmm. We've done an entire radio show on that. And what was fun with that show? We actually had people calling the station and talking to our guests in Plattdeutsch,
right?
And I was hoping that they weren't saying anything that I couldn't put on the radio because I didn't understand a word of it.
But that's such a part of the heritage of this part of the state that there's no getting around it, and that must have been a very difficult situation for some of those people who were immigrants or the sons and daughters of immigrants during the First World War.
You know, and if you go to Chicago today, there's a neighborhood called Avondale along Milwaukee Avenue on the north side where everyone speaks Polish. All the signs are in Polish. You can walk down the street, and you won't find anybody shopping, walking on that street that knows how to speak English. So in a sense, it does continue today. So my question is there some hypocrisy when the descendants of those German-speaking Americans now tell our new Hispanic immigrants that they need to speak English?
Well, there's certainly an irony. I think sociologists and linguists who have studied this find that, in fact, immigrants today acquire the language a generation faster than people did a century and a half ago. And I think a lot of that can be explained through things like television. You can turn on the television and listen to people speaking and pick up the language much easier than perhaps someone living in, a predominantly German community in 1900 would not have had as many opportunities to hear English spoken.
Right.
And so, but it is that whole question of hyphenated Americanism, 100% Americanism that sort of implied by that question is at the heart of a lot of this hysteria during World War I of people being the right kind of American.
Fred Barker, he's an associate professor of history at UW-Marathon County. Mike Jacobs joining us by phone from UW-Baraboosaw County on the 100th birthday, the centennial of the Great War to End All Wars. When we come back, we're going to talk about efforts to restrict free speech. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Grave responsibility rests upon us. This entire German salient holding up the Argonne advance depends for ammunition and supplies on the DeKalb Railroad, which, as you know, lies just beyond these hills. It must be taken. This is all open country ahead, but you can expect heavy machine gun fire from these wooded ridges on the right and the left flanks. But we've got to get through. Synchronize your watches.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Florentine Opera of Milwaukee, La Lingerie, and Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts, proud sponsors of WPR programs. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. More information at wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Northwind Renewable Energy of Stevens Point, designing and installing solar systems, highly efficient wood boiler systems, and providing deep energy retrofits to buildings. Northwind's project portfolio is available at northwindre.com.
How are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Harry? How are you going to keep them away from Broadway jazzing around? Think of the town. How are you gonna keep them away from harm? That's a mystery. Imagine Reuben when he meets his pa. He'll kiss her cheek and holler, ooh la la. How are you gonna keep them down on the farm after they've seen Harry?
If you just joined us, we're talking about the changes World War I made to America and North Central Wisconsin. We're listening to Eddie Cantor and his orchestra doing a song that was popular among returning World War I veterans. He is a white performer, but if you listen, you hear a Dixieland band arrangement behind him. And this, to me, is something that was significant that happened during those years. You had white musicians being influenced by black music, by Dixieland music, which became part of American culture for the very first time. And there was a lot of cultural upheaval happening at that time.
Absolutely. There's a great deal of concern about people fitting in and this sort of 100% Americanism I talked about before. That certainly goes against the Germans, but there's also a great deal of anger and violence towards African Americans during and just after the war as well.
Why don't we talk about that just briefly, since we seem to be on that track right now. This was a time of the Great Migration. We had African Americans leaving the oppression of the South, coming north, and they found that they weren't often welcomed by the white people who were living in the North at that time, Mike Jacobs.
Yeah, it's not that they weren't quite often not welcome. They were almost never welcomed. but it was a phenomenon that was going to happen largely because of the war, but certainly not exclusively for that reason. But if you look at, for example, Detroit, Detroit's African-American population increased times eight from what it was in 1910 to 1920. And, you know, those jobs are all war-related and then eventually become related to the auto industry. But what's also, you know, interesting to note there is that if you look at white migration from the South, you see a very similar phenomenon. So it's not just the lack of knowledge of whites in the North for African-American culture and this new competition for these jobs, but you'll have some of the existing prejudice that moves up with the Great Migration.
We had 30 race riots in America in those years following World War I, almost all of them in the North.
Yeah, well, that's really the interesting phenomenon that aggression by the larger culture against this minority group had been almost exclusively in the South for the last 75 years. But that changes at this time. And it's really surprising to students when they learn this, because when they have learned about racial prejudice most of their life, they think of it as a Southern phenomenon.
We had one riot that took place in Chicago in 1919. It broke out in Chicago after a black man was swimming at a segregated beach in Lake Michigan, and a white crowd literally stoned him to death. Then the riot lasted a week. 15 whites, 23 blacks were killed, more than 500 people injured. An additional 1,000 black families lost their homes when they were torched by the rioters. And here's an interesting side note. The riots were instigated in part by an organization called the Hamburg Athletic Club, an Irish organization that had as one of its members Richard J. Daley, who would later become the future mayor of Chicago. He, of course, denied being involved in the attacks during that time. So a lot of this stuff, Mike Jacobs, was happening pretty close to home.
Yeah, in fact, that organization, the Irish organization, was commonly called the Reagan Colts, not spelled like the former president. And you know what? We're talking about essentially social clubs / ethnic gangs. And African Americans were new competition for the lower level jobs that these people had come to dominate in Chicago.
And we also had a lynching in Duluth in 1920. I don't know if either of you could comment on that, but it gained national recognition at the time. A traveling circus troupe lynched by a mob in Duluth.
Yes, there was a young white couple that were apparently necking behind one of the tents, and the circus workers, the African Americans, were specifically set up breakdown guys. They were muscle employees, and we're not exactly sure what had happened, but the claim was that six African American men had beaten them both and had raped the woman. Well, in spite of the fact that the doctor's examination of the woman said that none of those things had happened, it didn't prevent there being really a radical racial fear that spread even beyond Duluth. It spread into Superior, where all African American workers were tossed out of town, were ordered out of town. The mob, and I can call it a mob, was able to break into the jail and get three of the men who were accused and lynch them.
And we have a friend of mine here on campus, Jim Rosenberg, was quoted in the newspaper the fact that in Wausau, going into the 1960s, black men were not allowed downtown after 7 o'clock at night.
Sure.
Whether by ordinance or whether it was simply police policy at the time.
Yeah, so, tradition. There's these things called sundown towns, and there's all kinds of books about them saying that, and African Americans, when the sun goes down in this town, you know, you better not be here.
So 100 years later, we still have racial tensions. Milwaukee, the most segregated city in the U.S., poor schools, and we've got a Black Lives Matter march that's scheduled in Wausau in May.
Yeah, so again, I think a lot of the roots of what we see developed during the 20th century, a lot of those trends can be traced back to the wartime and even further back. So I think to answer your question, began the program, why should people care about something that happened 100 years ago? Because these issues still, our society still faces these today.
I'm Glenn Moberg. We're talking about the 100th anniversary of World War I, its impact on North Central Wisconsin, with Brett Barker and Mike Jacobs, 1-800-780-9742. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-780-9742. Let's go to Rich in Rhinelander. Rich, you're on Route 51.
Thanks for the program. There were multiple waves of Germans that came to this country, and I was at a convention where Lee Sherman Dreyfus was the keynote speaker years and years back, and he made the comment that the Germans who came to the U.S., and particularly Wisconsin, were German pacifists. I wonder if your guests could comment on that, that they had seen what the rulers of Europe did with the common people, and they were largely suspicious of war.
Mike, you want to handle that?
What Graves was referring to is, commonly they're called the 48ers. And they were people who had been either expelled from Germanic states or who fled for political reasons. However, and I wonder what Brett will say about this, it seems that they're actually a very vocal minority. Yeah, they make up just a minority.
Rich, you're going to have to turn your radio down. I think Rich is listening off air right now. Go on, Mike.
Yeah, that's it. That we always celebrate the 48ers, and for good reason. They brought us a lot of good things. Kindergarten. They brought us a concern about free press. They brought us direct democracy. But they don't actually represent the vast majority of Germans who came to Wisconsin.
I think that's right. But I will say, though, while the 48ers are probably a small percentage of that migration, a lot of Germans who did come had come from a society where there was forced military service. And also, as we suggested, before the U.S. entry into the war, they saw their heritage, their culture, their ancestry, perhaps still living ancestors back in Germany, and they didn't have a strong desire to get into the war in one way or the other.
I think we're going to take another break right now, and then when we come back, I want to really focus on civil liberties and these court cases. Brett Barker and Mike Jacobs were talking about the centennial of World War I, why it's still important in North Central Wisconsin 100 years later. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51. Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network, and we're going to play another music clip right now. This is a gentleman named Jack Chapman who recorded this song in 1917.
What is the latest melody that calls the young idea? From a ticking to secret, and our response is your ear. That a hotel from Armand here, hallelujah. Mademoiselle from Armandier, say it's new. Sing it with all your heart and soul, and see everyone right up the pole. Mademoiselle from Armandier.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Wesley Heating and Cooling, TDS Custom Construction, and the Mead Witter Foundation. You too can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Find out more at WPR.org/sponsor.
A Yankee Doodle Dandy, Yankee Doodle do or die. A real live nephew of my Uncle Sam, born on the 4th of July. I've got a Yankee Doodle sweetheart, she's my Yankee Doodle joy. Yankee Doodle came to London just to ride the ponies. I am that Yankee Doodle boy.
And as James Cagney tap dances his way into our hearts, we're back on Route 51 with Brett Barker and Mike Jacobs talking about World War I, its lasting effects on America and North Central Wisconsin. 1-800-780-9742. If you'd like to join the conversation, that's 1-800-780-9742. I want to get into what is really the subject that you're going to be talking about April 8th. That's a Wednesday evening at the Center for Civic Engagement here on the UW Marathon County campus, and that's the effect of World War I on the way we treat free speech and we treat civil liberties, Brett Barker.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the important things to understand is that during the war, the United States Congress passed the Espionage Act in 1917, which was more narrowly focused on spying and interfering with war production. But in 1918, the Sedition Act, which is the first time in over a century that there had been a law against speech, and it specifically said that disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language against the government would be prohibited. And a lot of Americans, over 2,000 Americans, were arrested, over half of them convicted, for acts against what was seen as a Sedition Act.
Now, the Alien and Sedition Acts were passed in the late 1700s during the John Adams administration,
right.
And they were hated by the early Americans, and they ended up throwing Adams out of office and repealing those acts.
Yeah, the Federalists never elected a president again. It was very unpopular, and it had attempted to do more specifically to attack Jeffersonian Republicans. In that case, here it is any opponent of the war, and that becomes a much wider net. They go after organized labor. In some ways, it really gets completely out of control. A couple of crazy examples: a California man was arrested for laughing at some green recruits who were trying to learn how to march in a camp. And he just thought it was funny because they were so bad at it. He was arrested. Or, perhaps most famously under the Espionage Act, a man named Frank Montgomery had directed a film called The Spirit of 76, which was about the American Revolution. He was convicted because he had created a film in which Americans were shooting at our well-known British allies in World War I. But of course, this is a film about the American Revolution. So of course, Americans would be shooting at the British in that war. And so it really became a much wider net, and just all sorts of ridiculous excesses occurred for a very brief period during the war.
And these acts, both of them, were upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, but with some trepidation by one justice, Oliver Wendell Holmes.
Correct, particularly his decision in a dissenting opinion in Abrams versus the United States, where he was joined by Justice Brandeis. He said that the key thing is that speech that leads directly to dangerous actions can be prohibited, but you cannot punish people's speech when it is simply an expression of their own ideas. And so he came up with this idea of the marketplace of ideas, that in a free society, you should be able to say what you want, and that good, solid ideas would rise to the surface, but that being able to express one's opinions when it didn't lead to public danger should be allowed, because if they were not good ideas, Americans would sort out the good from the bad, and there was no real public danger in expressing one's thoughts.
And again, as we mentioned earlier, this is where the famous phrase, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater, as a way of restricting free speech. But these opinions are still affecting us today. How is this similar to our reactions against Muslims during the years after the September 11th attacks, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? How is it similar to the 1950s when we targeted alleged communists during the McCarthy era? And something I remember, the 1960s, when you had the New Left and protests against Vietnam, the Chicago 7 conspiracy trial, where these seven individuals were accused of conspiring to incite a riot. Many of them didn't even know each other very well.
I think it's the start of a conversation that Americans continue to have. In some ways, the entire modern conception of civil liberties comes out of this discussion. It begins really with the Sedition Act of 1918.
Mike Jacobs, you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, in fact, I think that this tendency has not left us. You know, 10 years after World War One, there was a court case regarding a woman by the name of Rosika Schwimmer, who was immigrating to the United States from Hungary and was seeking to become a citizen, but was denied based on her pacifist views. And it's like, you know, the war was over by 10 years by now. Oliver Wendell Holmes was the person who dissented on the case, saying that, you know, holding unpopular views is, you know, is that the government's responsibility to maintain your right to do so. And, you know, it's interesting that she's a woman, and who cares if she's a pacifist? She was never going to be drafted.
I want to go to the phones. We have Meg in Montello. Meg, you're on Route 51 with Mike Jacobs and Brett Barker.
Hi. I just wanted to share an interesting story that my mother-in-law told me. Her parents immigrated from Germany, and both her father and her uncle had been in the Army. Brought their uniforms with them just as, you know, memorabilia. And while they were in Wisconsin, living in Milwaukee, they received a letter from Hitler demanding that they return to the motherland, that they serve in the Army, you know, that that's what they needed to do. And they were terrified because at that time things were becoming kind of anti-German in the area. And so she remembers standing on the basement stairs watching her father and her uncle burn not only that letter that they had received, but their uniforms as well, just afraid that someone was going to lock their families up or something because of that letter.
Meg, thanks so much for the comments. Brett Barker, your reaction?
Interesting. Once again, of course, the issue of of Germans would come up in World War II, and that always is a difficult thing when your ancestry finds your is in from a country that now the United States is at war at.
Meg, thanks so much for the phone call, and let's go now to Mark, I believe it is, in Wausau. Mark, you're on Route 51.
Good morning. It's been rumored that the Lusitania was carrying ammunition, cartridges for Great Britain. And I'm just wondering if that story is true, because it reportedly was over 4 million cartridges in the bottom of that ship. And the government had forewarned the United States not to ship munitions via ocean liners to Great Britain.
I can address that. Maybe Brett can add some things to it. Yes, the evidence says that indeed there were munitions, but it wasn't a great amount. But there's been numerous books written on this immediately after the war, and then years after that. One of the interesting contentions by an American sailor who was on the ship not working was that when the boat got to an area that it might be targeted, he noted that it slowed down. He thought this was the place you should be going the fastest. So there was some ideas about a conspiracy theory from the very beginning.
It's also interesting, you know, one of the things we haven't had a chance to talk on, but during World War I, there's this tremendous explosion of poster art. And one famous poster shows a woman holding a child sinking to the bottom of the ocean, and clearly she's drowned as a result of Lusitania. And then there's sort of an anti-German slogan that's sort of the idea is the United States needs to get into the war because of German atrocities. Back to this about sort of the German, the brute.
Mark, thanks so much for the phone call. Gentlemen, we are just about out of time. We touched on the first Red Scare, which happened about that time. We had the Russian Revolution in 1917, and then we had the Palmer Act, in which we were trying to round up communists and socialists and anarchists and deport them, and all of that ties in with those court cases.
So there's much more that we'll that really is a pretty complicated story, but there is, even after the war, there is this time of hysteria in which there's an attempt to round up people who are seen as subversive or dangerous to the nation, and we'll cover that more probably on the 8th as well.
And we had labor strikes during that time, so labor
Absolutely.
Unions were being targeted.
And labor unions, particularly radical labor unions like the International, the IWW, some of their members were attacked. One of them was dragged behind an automobile until his kneecaps were scraped off entirely in this sort of hysteria that right after the war.
And it wasn't all hysteria, because there were actual bombs being mailed to public officials by people who were on the other side.
And largely unknown. And the last big incident, Wall Street was, the New York Stock Exchange was bombed in 1920, 38 people killed, and it's still unclear who did that. And before Oklahoma City, that remained the largest sort of domestic terrorism attack in U.S. history.
Mike Jacobs, there's certainly a lot to talk about.
Yes, absolutely. I'm looking forward to the 8th, and I hope we get a good crowd, because we've only just touched the tip of the iceberg here.
And it is amazing, isn't it, that 100 years later, this war that nobody really talks about, nobody thinks about, and it has really sculpted the America that we have today. It's changed the way we fight wars. And it's also changed the way that we live at home, Brett Barker.
Yes, I think that's true. And I think that we'll continue to draw those connections. And I think there are a lot of interesting parallels to be made.
Mike Jacobs, you've got the last word.
Well, you know, it's true that it's 100 years ago, and we're going to start taking notice of this because of this. But I'd ask your listeners, if they ever visit Washington, D.C. and go to visit our great monuments, see if they can find the World War I monument.
There you go. We want to thank today's guests, Brett Barker, Associate Professor of History at UW-Marathon County, and Mike Jacobs, Associate Professor of History at UW-Baraboo Sauk County. Our guests will lead a forum on World War I and civil liberties the evening of Wednesday, April 8th at the Center for Civic Engagement on the UW-Marathon County campus in Wausau, sponsored by the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, and our on-air producer, Jane Richter. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music and audio segments today by Nora Bays, Arthur Fields, the soundtrack to Sergeant York, Eddie Cantor, Jack Chapman, James Cagney, and Bob Crosby and his orchestra. We'll be right back. Remember to follow us on Facebook. This program will be put online and can later be downloaded at wpr.org/route51. It will not, however, be repeated Friday night on 90.9 FM this week, because we will be preempting Route 51 by a Wisconsin State Supreme Court debate. Thanks for riding along with us today. I'm Glenn Moberg, forward as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.